We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The ethnic festival season in Milwaukee continues next week with the nation's largest Irish Heritage Festival. It's the 35th annual Irish Fest, which connects well with a full 20% of the American population, which claims some Irish in their ancestry.
Ed Ward and John Maher have been with Irish Fest since, well, before there was an Irish Fest. They're part of the longtime Milwaukee traditional Irish band Blarney, which started 6 years before the festival began in 1981. But Ward says it was from that interest in the music that the festival emerged.
Blarney started in 75.
That's right.
And it started basically at a little chapel on the Marquette campus, the Joan of Arc Chapel, when Bernie McCartan and I were in law school, and we used to play for the folk masses at noon. So one Sunday after the mass, Father Mike McNulty gave us a Tommy Makem and Clancy Brothers songbook. So when we'd sit there and play these liturgical songs, after that we'd start singing some Irish songs. And John and I and Bernie were members of the Shamrock Club at the time. And so Bernie and I started singing these songs, the Moonshiner and the Wild Colonial Boy. And then I think we put an ad, John, in the Emerald Reflections that we were looking for a musician or a fiddler.
Well, I think you might have put an ad in, but I remember meeting you and hearing you announce that you were looking for someone to join this group at the February meeting of the Shamrock Club in 1975.
Yeah.
I came up to you after the meeting, you and Bernie, and mentioned that I had played for the Irish Dancers on the Summerfest grounds since about 1973. At the PAP stage, they used to have a different musical format. And Saturday and Sunday, they had ethnic dancers, and the Irish participated, and I played for them. So it seemed to be a good match, and I think within a week, we had our first rehearsal.
Had you listened to the traditional Irish stuff before that, or was this really kind of the start?
No, not much. I had lived in Washington, D.C. right before coming back to law school. I spent a lot of time at Matt Cain's, E.J. O'Reilly's. They were singing. They were the ballad-type shows. Not much trad music. In fact, once the band started playing, I think our first gig was at the Shamrock Club meeting 1 month, and we sang a couple songs, and then we sang at Al McGuire did the Children's Hospital run back then. I remember we did the after party at the Miller Inn for him, and then we played at the Mug Rack.
Oh, yes.
That was our first. Was that our first official gig?
No, actually, the first official one, I suppose, was at the post-parade party
year. Yeah.
But I do remember playing at the Mud Rack, and that was at the old Alumni Union on the Marquette campus on the south side of Wisconsin Avenue.
Yeah. Yeah, but the trad music we didn't start getting into until John was playing jigs and reels, and he was playing that for the Dancers. But when we got hooked into the touring band, trad bands at the time, which was De Donnan, and which was Michal, Kevin Burke and Michal O'Donnell, Trina O'Donnell, we had a fellow that used to come into Nash's Irish Pub that knew all these bands. His name was Chuck Judkins, and we'd sit and talk, and he'd give us tapes, and we'd listen to him. And then my brother Chuck and I got into the record business as distributors, and we hooked up with Shenicky and Green Linnet. Wendy Newton.
Great labels.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. And so we would have sales twice a year at Nash's. And for people that didn't have access to buying any of this Irish music. And so we were out there looking for music, but we were mostly focused on the ballad tradition at the time, the Irish Rovers and Makem and Clancy and the Dubliners. And that was kind of where we got our start. In fact, the first year of Irish Fest, I had gone to Danny O'Donohue and Derry Haggerty, and I said, hey, we don't have any money, and would you guys give me each $1,000 because I want to make an offer on the Irish Rovers? And they said, yes. Rovers were in town one March, and I went over to meet them at the, what used to be the Red Carpet Inn, and we talked about our festival. And about a week later, Les Weinstein, their agent, got back and said, no, Will's going to be in Ireland in August, and they can't do it, And we also had, I think, approached the Dubliners at that time, and were not able to do anything with them. But
didn't
we did.
You approach the Chieftains as well that first
Not the
year?
First year, but the first year I had tuned into Mick Maloney, and he had just done this big thing for his bicentennial a number of years before that, and put Greenfields of America together. So we said, well, this is perfect. This is trad music. They bring dancers with them. And so Mary Cannon, who was kind of the assistant festival director, worked with the city to do a grant. And we got a grant to bring in Greenfields. But the first year we knew, we certainly by 1980 and 81 knew enough about trad music. But it was an education. We were playing music. We were looking for music. We were learning more about it. We were distributing records at that time. So by the time the festival started, we had a pretty good broad view of who was out there. So we set out from the very start to make a broad variety of musical acts that reflected the American Irish song tradition, the folk tradition, the instrumental trad music, and, of course, culture. And the other thing that I remember Walt Disney once said, our goal is to entertain, but also to educate and not let people know it. And I kind of like that, because I think that's kind of been built into our core mission since the early years.
In that first festival, how many acts did you have and how many stages were you on in that first year? Do you remember?
We had the three major brewery stages.
It was Pabst, Schlitz, and Miller.
And those are the three main stages at the time. And then we had a little stage off on the lakefront that was for folk music. We had harpists there. And then we had a very lovely cultural exhibit the first year. That was the basics of the first year. I remember the police asked me after our first year how many people we had, and I had no idea because they didn't have turnstiles at Summerfest at the time. And I had noticed that Festa had said that they had 165,000 people. That was just a couple weeks for us. So I said, well, I think we had 110,000 people. I had no idea. Well, a couple years later, we backed out our revenue to actually try to figure out how many we actually had. And what was it, between 40 and 50,000?
Well, we figured that we had somewhere between 35 and 40,000.
I would say there are quite a few more people now coming through those gates.
Would say,
yeah. How many were last year? What was the count for last year?
A little over 115,000 last year. So we've been, since the recession in 08, we've been averaging between 115 and 122. Now, before the recession, especially in 2005, with our 25th, we had the president of Ireland here, Mary McAleese. We had 137,500 people there that year. But we were doing consistently 127 to 132 before the recession. And even with all the competition, there's a lot more festivals now all over the country, you know, many of whom started after they came here and saw what we were doing. And I mean, we're kind of called the mother of all Irish festivals for that reason, that, you know, we've been basically been the model for a lot of other festivals around the country.
The bands that I talk to that have come through here and people that I know because I have connections in Scotland, it's like bands want to come here. They mm-hmm. know it's a great festival experience, and they also say that the audiences are just so keen.
Yeah.
They're not just there to have a beer. They're there to actually hear the music as well. Was that something you wanted to make sure happened from the beginning?
Back then, when we were in the band, we were having fun. It was fun. We weren't thinking about we weren't even thinking about an Irish Fest in 1975. You know, in 1981, we were just concentrating on getting to the next year. And we weren't thinking about what's going to happen 25, 35 years down the road. But we knew we had something good going. Maybe you were, John. Maybe you were thinking 25 years ahead.
Actually not. When Ed asked me to assist with the festival the first year, I remember thinking this would be an interesting way to spend one weekend in August. And as we got into that, the concentration was solely on that first festival. It came to me as a great surprise how successful the festival became. We knew that if we had a good year the first year, we'd undoubtedly have a second year. But I didn't think there'd be this longevity, nor did I think that we'd have the acclaim that we've experienced.
Now that you've hit 35 years, you guys ever going to retire?
Well, you know, I think of my mother, who just turned 95. She's been involved with the festival for 35 years. She's still a coordinator. She can't do perhaps what she did many years ago, but she's still active and still involved. And I see roles, and at least in my part of the festival, I try to keep people involved to some degree as long as they possibly feel they can or want to. And I see Ed and myself in that same position. We'll be around for a while yet.
You're going to stick around for a little while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I plan to be around. I mean, I love the entertainment area. I mean, I've always been focused on the bands and the music. We've done a lot of really good networking. And, you know, it is a people business. So, I mean, we've done a lot in Ireland and the UK and Canada to establish networks and relationships and partnerships. And that's important. And I've been part of that. But my focus, as I continue to be involved, will be still on the music. That's what I really love.
Do you think that festivals like this one will continue to be healthy? Is the audience desire for them out there and still strong?
I think it is. In fact, I'm surprised at the longevity that these festivals have had and the success of the music and the popularity of it. And there are more festivals starting all the time. Now, there are some that aren't doing well and that are having difficulty because managing a festival of this size, it's very difficult to make money, particularly when you're dealing with 4,000 volunteers. You know, you've got to be very careful how you treat people. But we've stewarded our resources very well. And as a volunteer organization, we've done exceptionally well making good business decisions, but it's getting very difficult. The little festivals are at risk because they're small. And we're at risk because we're so big. You know, we have bad weather and all the increase in costs that we have to experience every year, and we can't just keep pushing ticket prices up. So we've got to depend on sponsorship and our ticket revenue, and then, of course, getting people on the grounds to spend money.
You know, I think one of the other benefits that we have, perhaps over other festivals in the United States or Canada, are the grounds themselves. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of a comment my godfather made to me years ago. He said, the parts or things about a good farmer, a successful farmer, is a lot of hard work, good ground, and good weather. And I think the clear comparison can be made with our festival. We do have a lot of hard work in terms of creativity, actual physical labor, and the execution of these plans. We have excellent ground. And over the years, we've had fairly decent weather. Some pretty bad years.
There's been some times, but, yes, you know, that's the one
thing
you can't control.
Good.
Yeah, you exactly. cannot control that part of it. You can do everything else. You can't control that.
I always got the kick when John Gerter goes out and does his talks about Milwaukee, talks about the festivals, he says that Irish Fest is the only festival that gets more people when it rains.
Ed Ward and John Maher are two of the founding fathers of Milwaukee's Irish Fest. The 35th edition opens next week, and it will bring in both musicians, authors, and other cultural ambassadors, some of whom you'll hear on Lake Effect. And that is all the time we have on this edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. But before we go today, we dip into our collection of Lake Effect interviewees warming up their chops by reading song lyrics. Here is foreign policy contributor Art Sear offering his interpretation of Pop Music, the classic 1979 tune by the British new wave band M.
Radio, video, boogie with a suitcase. You're living in a disco. Forget about the rat race. Let's do the milkshake. Selling like a hotcake. Try some. Buy some. Fee, fi, fo, fum. Talk about pop music. Talk about pop music. Get up. Get down.
Lake Effect's producers include Dan Harmon, Susan Bentz, and Audrey Nowakowski. And we have a lot of help from our team of interns, Claire Mosley, Tyler Nelson, Lily Wellen, and Eddie Otto.
We get studio engineering from John Strelecki and web support from Michelle Maternowski. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.